She was beaten to death, strangled to death. He destroyed her.
The anguish of Tanya's family would soon spread to many others. Through a bizarre twist of fate, my father would be free to kill for years to come.
He beat and he raped and he suffocated and he duct taped my mother and threw her off the side of the mountain. When I learned of my mom's death, I felt hurt, angry, lost in the ocean in a boat with no paddles or a compass on which direction to go. I felt like there was no life in me. I mean, I just collapsed.
Just the idea of my dad tossing her like she's garbage, having no remorse or any feelings for her, leaving her in a location where she might never be found. It just gives an eerie sense of the lack of compassion he has for human life.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard criminal behavioural analyst and co-creator and executive producer of The Case of Kayley Anthony, which is currently airing on Oxygen. And with me today is...
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, which has just gotten picked up for its 14th season, I'm very relieved to say. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the victims of those crimes.
And congratulations, Lisa. I was really pleased and excited to see that as well.
Me too. Jim and I are like, whew. But anyway, yeah, thank you.
Another season. Yep. Fantastic. And, you know, unfortunately, Jim can't be with us today. He's on his travels and taking a well-earned break. Whether he's really taking a true break and enjoying the wonderful beauty of the place that he's in, well, I'm going to quiz him on that when he comes back. So today we are really lucky to be joined by a very special guest who we're bringing back from our first episode with her because we had so much more to talk about. And we're joined in the booth by...
Melissa Moore. I'm the true crime correspondent for Dr. Oz. And as you just discovered in the last episode, my father is also a serial killer.
We should say that he is still incarcerated, multiple life sentences.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
He is. So he's serving three consecutive life sentences at Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. And in September 2009, he was indicted for another murder and was extradited to California to face further charges. And he also claimed that at one point that he had killed as many as 160 victims, but we are going to talk about the eight that we know about. And sadly, I'm sure that there are many others, but it's a real privilege to have you back. Thank you very much for sharing your time and your journey and your knowledge with us, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
So continue talking about when you met with Michelle.
Yes. So when I met with Michelle, I was with my mother, and when we first sat down, she was very tight-lipped, and she wanted to have a conversation, but she wasn't open at all. And it appeared to me intuitively that she needed to have a confrontation, but she was scared to have a confrontation. And so I just went ahead and said, go ahead, you know, tell me if it's not pleasant, go ahead and just tell me what you need to tell me. And that's when she told me about her assumptions of my involvement in a movie that was made. And I explained to her that wasn't the case at all. And then after that, then it was just like the energy in the room shifted. And I said, I'm really here to listen to about your, you know, I want to know about your sister, and please tell me about her. And that's when she pulled out the photographs, and I got to see Tanya in a very different light. She was a ray of sunshine. She lit up every single photograph. Like, she had this like megawatt smile. And she had a really close relationship with her sister. And this was a relationship that the sister felt protective over her, yet there was little that she could do. She wanted her independence. And that frightened her sister, you know, that she was, from what she said, she had a developmental delay. And so it made her vulnerable to the world. And that made her sister, you know, frightened about that. But They stayed in contact, and this was obviously the worst news that they could have ever heard. And especially the way my father, what my father had done to her.
What I found poignant about that interview, I mean, yes, it was very clear, you know, the way the interview first was that she was holding back and not saying what was truly on her mind. And obviously there's some conversations that aren't caught on camera, but actually she did make it very clear that, you know, Tanya was a very trusting person. There was no way she could have got away from your dad, and that he played God. Now, that was a very important insight from her, because that's exactly what he was doing. But then she said, and she repeated it 5 times, she said it was all about your dad. It's always, always been about your dad. It's never been about Tanya. None of the victim's stories have been told. And I thought that was one of the most important moments of her feeling validated and empowered to be able to be the voice for her sister. That was an incredible moment, because that was her truth. Mm. And you sitting there with your mother receiving it, was a very important thing to do, and it's a very courageous thing to do, and I really do applaud you and Rose.
I agree with her, though. I agree with her. And that's what's a struggle for me even to this day, is that as I go in the world and I work on crime stories, and I bring people, victims and family, I bring family members of victims on, or survivors on, to different platforms to share their story, it's always referenced back on my backstory, who I'm related to. And I know that's to give context of how I'm connected to crime, because obviously you have a degree, you've studied this professionally, and this has not been something that I went to school for. So people want to know, how did I even get into this crime space? And that's my connection to the space. But every time I share my connection to the space, I have to say who my father is. And so that's a double edge for me. And for a long time, I struggled with it, because I never wanted to say his name. And I have journal entries where I would write, like, when there's going to be a time where I don't have to say who I'm related to. But I understand it. I mean, I get it now that this is how people understand my connection to why I do what I do and why I care. And that's why I found this interview to be important, is that that's the purpose. Exactly what Michelle had mentioned in the interview as well, is that, you know, it's always been about my dad. And now I feel like this is a platform that I've been given to give, to help other people have their voice and the family members.
And I think that's an important part, because your mother says, you know, that she feels she's guilty by association, and that this is a big burden for you all to carry. But the way that, you know, the conversation then goes is that, you know, there are moments where you hug each other, and you do repeat to her a number of times that you're glad that she agreed to meet with you. And Michelle sort of closes sort of the interview with basically saying that she knows that Tanya would, now she's said her piece, she said that she knows that Tanya would now want her to let it go and to be happy. I mean, it was a really powerful moment where you see just something lift. I've seen that with victims that I've worked with, and families, where something just lifts. Not everything, but there is a lift of things that they've been holding and carrying, and that pain to carry it is so toxic and corrosive. So releasing it, because you're being the voice for someone and telling your story, you know, for both sides, is very valuable, you know, to ourselves as human beings to do, and to have that connection, which
you
had.
Well, she gave me a gift as well. So every time when I met with Dawn and when I met with Michelle White, the gift they give me is that exactly what you said, what my mother shared, which is guilty by association. I'm always afraid that they blame me. And so they give me a sense of solace as well, that they don't blame me for what my father did. And maybe that is, it's just healing to know that. And it's a sense of relief. And I know there's a lot of families out there that are related to a perpetrator, and they feel this sorrow that, like, for a long time, I didn't feel like I could be happy, that if I was happy in front of other people, that it would somehow be a slap in the face to the victims' families. Like, I had to, like, pay this sort of restitution, I guess, with my life. And I finally settled into the place where I had nothing to do with it at all. Nothing to do with my father's choices, his crimes, nothing. And once I had my peace with that, then I realized I can smile, I can be happy, I can, you know, not avoid the smiley face emojis. Like, that was difficult.
God.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like, I was afraid that when those emojis came out, that if I used a smiley face emoji, that people would be like, oh my God, just like,
right.
You know,
like,
and simple bother. Things everybody uses mm-hmm. triggers right. a reaction for you. And, you know, they're all valid things. But as you said, and I'm very clear about this, I was tweeting about it this morning, they are his choices. I wasn't tweeting about this case, but I was tweeting about what happened in Texas with the young man who made a choice to go into a school and shoot dead 10 people, including a girl who he was stalking and harassing. And a number of newspaper outlets said that because she spurned him, he then was violent and killed people. Well, no, she did not cause. Even in her death, she's being blamed. And I think this blame, you know, and shame.
That's interesting, too. I remember just when the Golden State serial killer was caught, we assume that this is the right guy, they chased after his girlfriend that left him years ago, and they said that Bonnie, because, you know, is she the reason why he went on this rampage? You know,
yeah, the Daily Mail, a UK rag, basically said, you know, the fiance, because she spurned him and rejected him, it then triggered. Well, no, it didn't. He was raping and abusing before that relationship when you track it back in time. But yeah, laying blame at the individuals, you know, who take those decisions, who choose to be violent and abusive, and he did. But there's a slight twist in the tale as well, Melissa, because, you know, if my research is right, your mother moved on to another relationship, and that relationship was abusive physically, and you children also suffered. And therefore, when your father was coming back on those, although the trips got fewer and fewer, it kind of drove you more to him, right,
yeah.
to get respite from what was going on
at home.
I thought
he was going to save me. I thought my father was absolutely going to save me, that he was my rescuer, that he was going to, because he was so physically dominating, you know, that he could take over the abuser. I thought he was going to save all of us from this horrible man. And so it was quite a twist to find out that he was actually more dangerous than the man that was abusing my mom and my siblings and I.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, if we put it in its reality, your father was way too selfish to even understand anything that may have really been going on in your lives, because he was just really all about himself, you know, me, myself and I. And they're really the only things that are on his radar. And I believe that even now, you know, to this day. You know, the letters that he wrote, so Lisa opened up with the question of how he gets that moniker, was from his own letters where he confessed. Mm. Well, he actually confessed on voicemail. I don't think I've ever heard a case where someone's confessed on voicemail.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Confessed with his own name? I mean, confessed, like, anonymously? Or?
So he called up the detectives. So when the detectives met with him after, in the wake of Julie's murder, and one of them gave him his card and said, you know, call me in his rapport building. Well, he did call, I think it was something like 4 or 5 days later, and he confessed to the murder on the voicemail. And then he called again, couldn't get hold of him, and so said more details about what he had done. I mean, I think that's quite astounding in and of itself. But of course, with Tanya Bennett's case, you know, we didn't talk about this in detail, but you mentioned it in your introduction. Two people were arrested and were in prison. So there were some twists and turns in this case, but two people were arrested. One was a female called Laverne, who kind of put herself into the investigation when Tanya's body was found. She basically said it was her partner, John, who had killed her. And she went to great lengths in a way, didn't she? She
yes.
found
a mile marker.
Yeah, she cut out a piece of gene material and said that that's what she had found in John's possession. She had
Well, and then she said she actually took the detectives to the mile marker where Tanya's body was found. And how she found that spot is that she's familiar with the area, which is kind of like a foresty area with switchbacks. And she was able to do that by reading newspaper articles, where one article said she was found near this mile marker. So she recalled that. And so when the detectives took her back up there, she was able to identify the area.
So was she deliberately trying to pin it on this guy? Or did she really think that this guy had done it?
Trying to pin it on her boyfriend. I believe she stated that she was abused.
That he was abusive. Mm-hmm. So she also said that she'd found her purse and his possession. So it led detectives down this route. You know, perhaps they didn't check and corroborate things in as much detail as they should have, but they were in prison at the time. Now, your father, and I'm intentionally not mentioning his name, decided to then write in a public toilet at a truck stop another kind of confession note. He actually graffitied that he was the one that killed Tanya Bennett, and therefore his narcissism is really the key issue, that he doesn't want two other people, you know, arrested. In one sense, he did, because it meant that he could carry on his crimes. But in another sense, he wanted the credit and the glory, because this is the thing that he's now successful at. But he wanted, and this is the real nub, he wanted people to know that this is the thing that he's successful for.
Instead of having been relieved that it was pinned on somebody else and he could continue, I mean, it was...
He would often say that killing people is hard. That's very difficult. Like he was trying to explain that it's not, it's way harder than we would anticipate. I didn't argue with him on that, but because I wouldn't know. But he made it sound like it was a difficult thing to do. What I'm curious about, Laura, is when he left that voicemail. Going back to the voicemail, some people have said this to me. Like, do you think your dad ever wanted to get caught? And I never had an answer for that. I don't believe he really wanted to get caught, but what would be your take on that?
Well, you know, the conflict that they have is what I just described, is the narcissism, you know, and it's the ego that in one sense they want people to know what they're doing, you know, because it is this real sense of, you know, excitement. And if they're getting one over, in particular on law enforcement, they think they're smarter. They want people to know that, you know, this is the thing they're good and they're successful at. But the other aspect is, of course, they want their freedom. They want their liberty to be able to continue to do and have their, you know, be autonomous in their decisions. So it's my belief no serial killer actually wants to get caught. But the leakage around their narcissism and the fact that the more that they do it and they're not detected means that sometimes they can be... careless and reckless in the choices and the decisions that they take. You know, for example, you met Julie, and you know the last victim that we know about, he was in a relationship with her. Now, she had introduced him to her mother, you know, and to you, and so people knew that they were associated with each other. You know, that was probably the first door knock that should have happened, was on his door as soon as she was found, her body was found. He was a person who stood out. And that was incredibly reckless for him to kill her. But the point of fact is, he's thinking, well, he's been doing all these other crimes and murders, and there probably are some near misses, and he's not getting the door knock. And therefore, he becomes more careless, you know, and disregards risk issues and countermeasures that when he first started out, you know, and of course, he's learning as he goes along that he would attend to. But the fact he's physically strangling, you know, I always say, you know, with strangulation, it's a high risk factor to serious harm and homicide in a domestic violence situation. So the minute there's hands around the neck, it increases the risk sevenfold to homicide. So the fact that when we track back, you talked about the kittens, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if actually it was manual strangulation, you know, and he probably just drops the bodies on the ground. And obviously for a kitten, if it's 6 foot... six, and you know, it's dropping half that distance, and their skulls are very fragile, you know, because they're kittens. And that would probably, you know, if I was to say how he killed them, that probably would be it. If strangulation was,
that would
make
sense, because he did with adult cats. That's how he killed the older cats, was the same way,
right? And he was abusing animals from his childhood. I mean, you know, and again, it's not you know, looking at his childhood, it doesn't excuse what he's done. You know, I call them psychological autopsies, where you go back in time and you look at how somebody was socialized. But his psychosocial development's really important. And the fact that he came from an abusive home, his father, was abusive to him. His grandfather was, you know, there was a line of behavior within the family. And it sounds like, from what you told me, that he really took the brunt of a lot of the abuse and the violence. And he was sort of the standout kid because of how he looked, that he was kind of outcast as well, which doesn't excuse him in any respect, but it holds a mirror up and a lens to understand his decisions and his choices when he's abusing animals. It shows lack of empathy, and there certainly doesn't seem to be any remorse. There's responsibility taking because he wants the claim and he wants the credit.
The father that I knew disappeared. I remember one summer in 1990 coming to stay at my dad's house here, and I had a hard time sleeping one night, and so I went to the living room and I laid on the couch and I started to gaze up at the ceiling, and I saw these odd brown marks on the ceiling. I never brought it up with my dad, and I never thought it could be blood.
I have a question for you. I think something that has been of interest to me is that when I've spoken about the animal abuse and then I've spoken about the eight victims, it feels to me that the public is more repulsed and outraged at the kittens than they are about the victims.
Right.
That's been the response back to me, and it always is shocking to me. I actually had a New York Times writer refuse to write an article because of the story of my recollection of the kittens.
And you know, Melissa, I would concur with that. Across my career, my 20 years, I stand in classrooms, you know, and I'll be doing it again in, you know, all next week and the week after, training law enforcement and professionals. And I would talk about a lot of cases. I would talk about child abuse, and I'll talk about domestic violence and sexual violence and homicide. When I come to the high risk factor that is animal abuse or pet abuse, and I show pictures and talk about, you know, dogs having their throats slit and left in baths for their owners with a clear message of "you're next," people can't handle it. You know, I'm talking about law enforcement officers who are uncomfortable in their chairs, who are hiding their eyes behind their hands. And I always comment to them and I say, I have just talked about, you know, scores of cases where women have been mutilated and children have been killed, and you have not batted an eyelid. But yet when I talk about animals, people react in this way, that they emote and they get far more upset. And I think that that is very true of, you know, why we have more animal sanctuaries than we do have people sanctuaries, rescue sanctuaries.
I mean, do you think it's because, you know, we see a lot of this depicted in front of us all the time? I mean, my show in you know,
Right up
there, because we see the abuse fictionalized constantly, and we rarely see that animals depicted that way.
You know, I think it's something that, you know, perhaps some people do get anaesthetized too, but it is really concerning because it shows really where, you know, our shock and our horror lies, and we should all be absolutely appalled and you know, taken aback when women and, you know, children are being mutilated or tortured or abused. And, you know, one of the stalking cases that I had where, you know, and she's still a client of mine, thank goodness she survived, and she reported to the police over 5 years, and he was turning up at her home address, terrorizing and terrifying her. And 2 weeks before she was attacked, and he stabbed her multiple times, having dragged her into a churchyard, stabbing her all around the face and the neck with scissors that he stole from her apartment. 2 weeks before, he left a tortured and mutilated dead cat on her doorstep. And yet that was reported to police. They didn't think it was a risk factor, which is a high risk factor. And when Helen Pearson and I do news together, because we will talk about stalking, we'll talk about 100% failure rates from when the police forces, six of them were inspected to look at stalking in particular, and there was 100% failure rate. We went on all the news outlets talking about the case. Not one wanted us to show pictures or to talk about, you know, the dead cat. And yet that escalation to homicide, I mean, it, you know, but people react to the dead animals. So it's an anomaly in some ways. I think it's something that people, we really want them to make the connection as well between animal abuse and torturing animals to torturing and harming people or coercively controlling people, because that's how pets can be used. You know, the FBI did some analysis and research and they found that the triad, you know, this kind of continuum to escalating behavior, that serial killers, not all of them, but a large number of had in common. And it was sort of the bedwetting, the fire setting and the animal abuse and torture. And, you know, your father was fairly textbook, I have to say, in terms of, you know, when you look at the psychological autopsy to where he was, you know, and how his psychosocial development to, you know, his relationships. And yes, serial killers do get married. And I say this time and time again, they don't just grow off a tree or wake up one day and decide to do these things. And, you know, unfortunately, this is the family that you came from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, you're still having to deal with, you know, or come to terms with the learning and the lessons and how to move forward in the shadow of the things that he has chosen to do.
What strikes me about listening to you and just getting to know you and your energy and how gentle you are and how easy it is to talk to you, that, you know, you had nothing to do with his crimes, but you've had everything to do with healing and helping and pushing good into the world. And hopefully you feel that. And also, you know, as we were just sitting here chatting before it started, I asked Melissa, you know, what her father's name was. We're not going to say it here. And I said, you know, I don't recognize that name at all. But, you know, where you're from in your neck of the woods, you know, it is still recognized, but it won't always be. And you won't, you know, you can claim to be, you can make the claim to be the daughter of a serial killer. And that puts you at a table to help others, but you don't have to necessarily identify who he is. So in some ways you can be free of him as the person, yet still have this credibility, you know, behind you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's actually a great tip.
When I think about what my dad stole from the victims' families, from the victims themselves, I can't even comprehend their loss.
It's just, there's not any resource to go to. Like, what do you do when you find out this? And then how do you deal with the world? You know, and for a long time, I just hid out and would actually come up with scripts. You know, when people ask, when it was really hard around holiday time when people would ask, like, what are you doing for holidays? Are you going to, you know, what about your parents? And then I came up with a script that, oh, we had a falling out, because that simplified it. It just made it so nobody dug any further because it sounded sensitive, you know. But now I'm a mom, mm-hmm. and I have teenage children who are asking questions. And my children, you know, their friends are aware of what I do for work and are aware of who their grandfather is. And we don't call him grandpa. We don't give mm-hmm. him that title in our house. He's just known as Keith. And honestly, like, I don't even know if I'm handling it okay with my own children. Mm. I know my mom has said to me just recently that she regrets how she told me and my siblings. And
how did she tell you?
She, when my father was arrested in March, it was after school and she brought us all together and she said, your father's been arrested. And she was reluctant to say for what. And then my brother pushed her and said, like, you know, why has he been arrested? And that's when she finally said, it's been for murder. And we,
for Julie. For
but
Julie
she
Winningham.
Didn't say Julie Winningham. Mm. She didn't say who, what, you know, where, like any details. She didn't say how. So our
teenage brains instantly means that you want that detail, right?
Oh, yeah. Immediately I want detail. I want to know the whole picture because my mind started making the picture for me then.
Which is somehow worse.
It
was. When we don't know things.
Yeah. It was. And then in my mind, you know, I ran through scenarios. I thought my dad's large. He could accidentally kill someone with his sheer size and get if he got in a fight. But then I'm like, he doesn't really get into fights with men. And then I thought about women. And then I thought about the cats when he would strangle cats in front of us. And then I thought that's how he killed someone is with his hands. I knew that. I settled in with that night. But then as time went on, I still didn't get answers, so I would go to the library and I would read all the news articles that was happening around my dad. And I would read what the victims' families were saying about my dad. And I know I remember feeling intense amount of shame and hurt to read how much they wanted. They called my dad a monster. They wanted him to die. And that's hard to hear with someone that you loved. And to first hear that people want your parent to die, that's mm-hmm. really hard to hear. Even though I understand where they're coming from.
Of course.
It's just difficult to hear someone say they want your parent to be dead.
Yeah.
It was at the time. Now I get it. But now being a mom and trying to tell my children, over time I've told them as they ask questions, is actually what got me to be where I'm at today is my daughter. When she was in kindergarten, she asked me, she got off the bus and she was making a family tree. And she knew her dad's side of the family tree and she could feel that in. But there was this one hole and that was my father, her grandfather. So she wanted to know the name. And she's like, everybody has a daddy. Who's your daddy? So she could fill that in for her assignment. And I wasn't prepared when I had children. I knew that conversation would happen. I, in my mind, envisioned her being a teenager when I would have this like sit down and it would be like a one-time conversation. But when she was just a little girl in kindergarten asking me this, I didn't know what to say. And so I immediately just told her he lives in Salem. And that's the information I gave. I said he lives in Salem and I helped her fill out the name on the form, on the tree. But I was thankful she didn't ask any more questions. But over mm-hmm. the years, she obviously did. And then my son has just recently confessed to me that he's Googled him. And mm-hmm. and I had a sit-down conversation with him just 2 weeks ago, you know, having a frank conversation about my son has my dad's hair.
Yeah.
And what happened is that he was looking for a picture for some assignment, and he saw on my computer a picture of my dad, and he thought it was him.
Mm.
And I had to tell him, you're nothing like your grandfather at all. You're nothing like him. You'll never be like him. And he was terrified.
Right.
You know?
Gosh, I want to remember who we were talking to about this. Laura, I don't think that you were there, but it might have been with Joelle Castaic. But she was explaining how to talk to children about this very subject, especially if a parent is you know, an offender and has to be punished and go to prison, and how to sit with them and explain, you know, this is what's happened to daddy or to your grandfather, but it's not you. And like a really great step-by-step way for them to understand it. So
it's hard because if that person is a bad person, mm-hmm. you know, then if your identity is like you must, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, you think people look at you and they see traits and you think like, well, they're going to see the bad. Then they're going to think I'm bad, too. And that's been actually a question for me. And I asked you, Laura, like at dinner, just about what I want to understand is, you know, how my father became who he is today. And then what risk does that put me, like genetically or my children? Like, I don't believe my children are really kind and there's nothing psychopathic about my children. They're very generous and kind people that have empathy. And I've witnessed that and I've been looking for that to make sure of that. But it was always something that I was looking for.
Sure.
And I wish as a parent that I wasn't looking for those signs. Like I wish I was every other parent that was just like, oh, look at my nice kid, you know, never questioning.
Right.
I mean, we've talked about this, you know, before on Real Crime Profile, and it is the nature and the nurture together. You know, I mentioned to you Professor James Fallon, who I know you had heard his name before, and, you know, he's a neuroscientist, and we talked about him. Jim and I know him. He's done a very enlightening TED talk, a 10-minute talk about the fact that he found out through some blind trials that he was doing as a neuroscientist that someone in his family had the MAOA gene, the psychopathy gene, and he unblinded that trial and it turned out to be him. Now, he didn't believe that reading at first and he basically thought the machine was broken and it did turn out to be him, and he's, you know, one of the leading experts on the subject. you may have to carry that gene, but you have to be in a certain circumstance and it is an abusive or violent environment for it to be expressed. And this is why it is the nature and nurture. And it tends to be carried on the mother's line. You know, some of the traits that you look out for are, you know, things, if you look at Dr. Robert Hare's psychopathy checklist, the PCLR, you know, I was just going through thinking about your father of, you know, it was his narcissism that really got him caught, you know, writing those letters to say, you know, it's not those people that are in prison, you know, and 3 years after Tanya Bennett's. And actually, some of the letters that I have seen, he actually gives a lot of information out about himself that is accurate information, you know, about the fact that he was married and he got divorced, you know, and was his narcissism. He wanted them to know that they had the wrong people, but the shallow effect, the callous disregard, the deception, the manipulation, the superficial charm, because he could be quite charming.
Correct.
And is quite charming. I remembered you saying that to me. The no remorse, attachment issues, being glib, the impulsivity, you know, abusive relationships. And of course, when we talk about abuse, we're not talking about the physical, it's the coercive aspect. So if he was sexually pestering, you know, the sexual promiscuity, if he was always haranguing and harassing your mother to have sex with him, you know, and so her saying, put it in the keyhole, it probably relates to that, that he was just constantly demanding things from her. But the grandiose sense of self, I mean, he would score highly on the PCLR. And, you know, my advice for you, you know, remains the same as when we initially had the conversation is, you know, I would follow up with Professor James Fallon and you know, be brave and take the tests and the insight that he can offer to
it's
you.
It's absolutely terrifying, though, too, because to think that genetically I'm predispositioned to be as my father, not something that would be terrifying, because I already have the stigma of living with a father that is a serial killer. But then to be a psychopath as well would be.
Well, there are many of them walking around, Melissa.
Yeah, right. You already know a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, the fact is, you know, people say it's 1% of the population. Well, no, it's never been screened for because it wasn't in the DSM. Four, or it's now going to come
Could
into the
you
five.
Imagine people would then take a look at me like under a microscope.
Like, but that this is your private information, though. This is not something to tell the world. It's just for your own
consumption.
And remember, you know, that for it to be expressed, there are certain conditions.
Well, you said violent, that it has, you had to be like incubated in a violent environment. And like that's what I was raised in, a violent environment, and it hasn't been expressed. So that gives me hope.
A lot of people are, and you're not a psychopath. I'm not a professional, but I can tell you that.
There are protective factors, and this is something that I think it would, you know, be a really good conversation for you and James to have, because he is a psychopath. He, you know, was surprised when he learned that, and his mother turned around and said, "Why are you surprised? Why do you think we put you in so many after-school activities? Why you were in so many clubs? Why do you think we just loved on you so much? We gave you no room or space. We loved you so much that it would not be expressed." So, you know, your environment, the things that you create, your children's environment, how you're raising them, their psychosocial development, that just because it may be present and, you know, you may have the MAOA gene, but that doesn't mean to say that it will be expressed. And there, look up, you know, past and present presidents. You know, there's a thing called psychopaths in suits. You know, Enron, Arthur Anderson came tumbling down because it had psychopaths at the top of it. I have worked with numerous psychopaths. They are undiagnosed, but I can tell you that that's what they are. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily, you know, there are many papers that you can read on it, you know, psychopaths in suits. And so James Fallon would talk about how he self-regulates and polices himself. And so, you know, it's not the end of things, as scary or as frightening as it might be, but I still think that our minds, the way they work, it's worse sometimes just not knowing.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
We fill in the gaps, and those gaps tend to be worse than what the truth is. And once you know the truth, you can deal with it appropriately. But of course, it's a choice, and it's a matter for you. But I think you've dealt with things so courageously thus far, you
Thank
know,
you.
As has your mother, and it can't have been easy. And, you know, we've enjoyed, Lisa and I, having you on to talk to us about your journey.
This has been a pleasure to chat. Like, you guys make it comfortable.
Oh, good. Good. I mean, I've learned so much. I mean, I hate to say this, but I would never know what your background was if you hadn't told me. You know, you just have
that's
an air.
What people would say, though, to me, you said it nicely to me. Other people say, but you look so normal.
Well, what is normal? I mean, honestly, I can talk on that subject for a very long time. You know, there's no such thing as normal. That's a
no, there isn't. Well, oh, boy.
At least she didn't say that. That is like verbatim what people say.
No, we're not normal. In fact, if you take the psychopath test, so will I.
Okay,
and we'll take it together and we'll see what happens. And what is the title of the documentary that Laura was talking about earlier?
It was Monster My Family, and it was, I believe, episode 1.
And where can people watch that if they'd like to?
I think now it's not on the air any longer.
Okay.
So I think
it's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I would say to our listeners to watch it. And actually, there are some other very interesting episodes as well. And I think the POV, you know, is one that needs to be explored. And being respectful of the victims, which, you know, there was that respect. And, of course, there are some victims in this series who haven't had a voice at all. And I still feel, you know, those who haven't even been named and buried,
yeah,
you know, with their name and their loved ones paying their respects, you know, I'd like to dedicate this podcast to them, because that's something that no one should ever go to their grave, you know, were A, in a remote area being put out like the trash, but B, you know, not being buried in a way where their families can say goodbye to them. So there are families out there that still haven't got those questions answered. So giving a voice to the victims, even those who are unnamed, is important. And, you know, those who are out there who may even listen to this, Lisa, and may well be have been a victim at his hands, because he was such a distinctive looking person, just because of his size and, you know, and his weight and the fact he was a truck driver. Well, he was scaling the length and breadth of America. He was Canadian born, right, as well.
Right. I mean, there's an image in my mind of seeing my father at night getting his running shoes on and heading out late at night and being gone for hours. And I would ask him, you know, as he was leaving, like, you know, why are you running so late? And in my mind now, I always go back to, he was always, when I was with him, he was doing things like that, just odd hours and time. And now I wonder, who is he hunting at night? Mm-hmm. You know, what happened that night? I don't know. Maybe nothing, maybe something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that predatory behavior, you know, and there is that hunting, that stalking behavior and that power and control that he derived from his behavior. And that's what he was seeking, you know, that.
Yeah.
Child that was abused, that never had that power. It was all about, sadly, taking that power back. And there were countless women who paid the price, sadly.
One last thing I want to ask you is, you know, you mentioned there's no blueprint, there's no how-to book for you as a child of an offender. But is there
a mother?
Is there any kind of support group? Is it something you'd ever want to start for, you know, the family of offenders, you know, especially violent offenders, for them to come together and get support and do, you know, do something really positive?
I've thought about it. And what would be so beneficial is there was this one case out of Belgium that there was a professor that was a serial killer and he had two teenage daughters. And I remember the counselor reached out to me because she knew about my story. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from their counselor, the young girl's counselor. And one of the girls wanted to commit suicide because it's standard. So what happens normally, when this is found out about a family member, is for the children, what happened to me is the families around me, my friends' families, didn't want me around them anymore.
Yeah.
And so with these two little girls, what they were struggling with is parents were calling the teachers and asking for their children to not be sitting there next to these two little girls. And so the counselor reached out to me, and I actually put her in touch with this other serial killer who had two beautiful college-age girls. And they could relate. And so I connected them together, mm-hmm. and they wrote a letter to these girls.
Right.
And this made a difference to show, you know, things will get better. This isn't your burden, that there's help for you. Mind you, it's such a small, small.
But is it though? Is it small? I mean,
well, it depends on it's a small club when it comes to perpetrators that are serial killers. That it's not when you think about, you know, domestic violence, when you think about homicide. I mean, when it comes to that scope, it's a massive club, unfortunately. And right. I don't know really what we could do other than rally together like a
No, I think I think that might be something really important for you to start. I mean, you know, not to put more on your plate, but you just have to start it and say, this is what it's called. This is, we're here for you. These are the, you have so much to give, you know, so much advice to give. And you're learning more and more on how to deal with your own story and recovery and healing and lifting the burden off of people. I think that's such a powerful thing. So,
of course, that's if, you know, you want to go there.
And do it. Not always, do it, Melissa.
Sometimes people don't always want to be defined by the things of the past. And, you know, sometimes it's about the forward trajectory. And, of course, you're a mom and you've got young children.
Well, it yeah, definitely is of interest. I think honestly, just being frank, I'm nervous that if I made a club like that, that they would get hurt. I know that sounds, that they don't want to be discovered. Normally, in a public way.
Sure.
And if I created, say, a Facebook page for them, then people could go in and discover them, and that they can, their private thoughts are then exposed. Does that make sense?
Sure. But I think there are all kinds of organizations for people who want to remain anonymous. I mean, any of us who have experienced sexual abuse or anything, you know, we want to be anonymous, but we want to get help.
Right.
And so there could be something that you set up like that, that is just, you know, a nonprofit that has a website, that has all kinds of resources, that has all kinds of, you know, your blog posts or whatever, that, I mean, you just help so much. I mean, even right now, somebody listening to you, I know right now, can relate, and you'll have helped somebody right now without them ever coming forward and identifying themselves and with ever them having some sort of infamous serial killer as a father, you know? So it would just be great to have like one, a place that people could go.
You know? I agree with you, because it's so the... No matter whether the parent is a serial killer or someone who watched their father, you know, viciously attack their mother, or, you know, it's just, it's all, I'm not going to say it's all the same, but it's this, pain is pain.
Yep.
And it's definitely like, it would be a nice place. I know I would have actually loved to have a place to go and talk to someone and say, hey, this is my experience. So I think you're onto something. I will definitely look into how to structure it. I think that's just what's been daunting.
And I think, you know, we can definitely help you do that. Okay. So anyway,
that'd be great.
Yeah, so there'll be people listening. So, you know, and dealing with the shame and the blame and all those feelings that people suppress and push down and compartmentalize. So yeah, that sounds like a worthwhile thing to do if you have the energy and drive to do so.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Melissa, it has been so great to have you here. It's so generous of you to come in and talk to us, and
we really appreciate it. I mean, it's, you know, really enlightening, and we do want to learn from cases as well and from offenders. So we don't mention their names, we don't give them the airtime or the narrative, but the insight and analysis that you provided is very enlightening. So thank you for being so honest and open and transparent and sharing your journey with us.
Thank you for having me, ladies.
I know Jim wishes that he were here. Hopefully if you come back again, once you start your nonprofit, we can get an update with you, and Jim will be here to talk to you too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so also with Jim not being here, I just want to make mention of our show, The Case of Kaylee Anthony, which you can watch. It's in three separate parts. It premiered on May 19th and then on the 20th and 21st. In fact, tonight is the last part to the case. So if you haven't seen it, you can go to oxygen.com. There are various clips there. And I know that it's now available on iTunes. So please do have a look at it. And so for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out. If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org, and there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.